Welcome to my Claim Your Worthiness podcast, Intimate Conversations with Gail Jones. We all have a safe place within to create anew. In each episode, I hope to add to your inner sanctuary to strengthen the belief in yourself and your dreams. Claiming our worthiness sets the foundation for centering us back into our greatness. From this foundation, we create our most amazing lives. I'll be sharing insights and resources from my own journey and from others who are transforming their lives. Lean in and receive the wisdom shared. You are worthy of having this special time with yourself. Hello, I'm Gail Kernan-Jones here today with my guest, James Cruz, who will be teaching us about becoming more mindful and joyful during these challenging times using poetry to uplift and inspire. James Cruz is the editor of the best-selling anthology, How to Love the World, Poems of Gratitude and Hope, which was just published to rave reviews March 23rd of this year. How to Love the World contains works of 100 of the best-loved and emerging writers, including Amanda Gorman, Ted Kuza, Mark Nepo, and Jane Hirschfeld. The book invites readers to use poetry as part of their daily gratitude practice, accompanied by prompts for reflection. These are poems you'll return to often for inspiration and creative exploration of life's daily gifts. The writers within will share relatable reminders to slow down, rediscover the beauty and gifts of ordinary life, and reconnect with the things that matter most. And later in this interview, James is going to tell us a little bit more personally about what matters most to him. James is also the author of 3 collections of poetry: The Book of What Stays, Telling My Father, Bluebird, and Every Waking Moment. His poems have appeared in Plowshares, The New Republic, and The Christian Century, and have been reprinted in former U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kuza's weekly newspaper column, American Life and Poetry, and featured on Tracy K. Smith's podcast, The Slowdown. Cruz holds an MFA in creative writing from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a PhD in writing and literature from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He worked with Ted Kuza on American Life and Poetry, which reaches millions of readers across the world. He teaches poetry at the University at Albany and lives with his husband on an organic farm in Shaftesbury, Vermont. Welcome, James. I'm thrilled to have you on today's podcast to provide a joyful, mindful perspective on these historic times, particularly the gifts of stillness and nature, which are consistent themes in your book. Before we elaborate on what called you to create your latest book now, I'd like to hear a bit about your personal journey of claiming or reclaiming your own worthiness before becoming the successful poet and professor you are today.
Yeah, so I feel I'm not very old, but it does feel like a long journey. It feels like it's taken me a while to reach the point where I can really call myself a poet and really embody my own creativity. I started out writing poetry when I was in the third grade, when I was just 8 years old, and I really loved it from the start and was encouraged by grade school teachers and people who really responded to the writing and just kept me going and kept me going. But I don't think it was until I went to grad school for writing that I realized you could actually make a living doing this and that you could teach, that you could publish books and things like that. I didn't really think that was possible. I grew up very poor near St. Louis, Missouri, and neither of my parents had gone to college. Neither of them had even finished high school. The possibilities for me and what I wanted to do just didn't seem very open. Mm-hmm. So it's taken me a long time, I think, to just settle into and accept that this life I'm living now of creativity and the daily joy of being able to feed my own writing and my own poetry practice alongside my spiritual practice, it's just taken a long time to get here. Mm-hmm. The thing that has helped me the most actually is the practice of writing things down and just writing poetry, because I often use poetry as a way to bring myself back out of my mind and back to the moment. I use poetry, of course, to process difficult moments, sadness, and mm-hmm. certainly grief. But I have come to see poetry also as a great way to claim not just our worthiness, but also our joy. And I feel like that's missing a lot from American life and probably life on this planet right now, that we don't always give ourselves permission to really sink into the joy. Oftentimes we look for ways to short circuit the joy that we're feeling because it feels so unfamiliar. So I really try to use my poetry as a grounding practice to stay more with the joy as it comes up. Like last night, I was talking with a friend on the phone and sitting outside on the porch and just listening to the crickets mm-hmm. and feeling the sunshine. And it's just, oh my gosh, I have to write about this. Right. I have to write this down to hold on to it. Right. I think we don't always hold on to moments of joy or excitement if we don't find a way to capture them. Mm-hmm. So if we don't write them down or share them with friends.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back for a second, that's very beautiful how you just shared that, holding on to those moments. Was there any curveball or childhood trauma that I can imagine growing up with parents that didn't go to college and didn't finish high school, and here you are, an accomplished professor and poet now, but were there any particular curveballs that sent you down into a deeper discovery of your own worth?
I would say there were a few curveballs that were thrown my way. The first one was growing up with a mother who had agoraphobia. She also developed MS, multiple sclerosis, later in life. And it was really difficult in our house to feel like we could ask for attention, or mm-hmm. I have a younger brother as well. And the issues that my mother was dealing with were so overwhelming at times. She couldn't work. There were times when she couldn't even leave the house or drive a car or anything like that. There wasn't a lot of room for, you know, my own needs or the needs that might have served my creativity. And the same for my brother as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other curveball was when I was 20 years old, my father suddenly passed away, and he was only 43 years old.
Sorry.
And thank you. He had hepatitis C that we discovered he acquired from some homemade tattoos that he had gotten as a kid. I guess he and some guys in his neighborhood had shared the same bottle of ink, and one of them had it and so passed it around to the whole group, actually. And there wasn't a cure for hepatitis C at that time. So he passed away rather suddenly. And I think that was probably the most difficult time in my life because he had always been the caretaker of all of us. He's a mechanic, so he fixed everything emotionally and physically in our house. Mm-hmm. So fixed all the cars and fixed all the problems that we had in our house. And so losing him was quite traumatic for all of us. And I would say for my mother, especially. I went to college close to home in St. Louis, and that worked out well, but it was a very distracted time. Mm-hmm. And I think my own creative life wasn't able to bloom until I had to go away to go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which isn't too far from St. Louis, but it was far enough for me to really spread my wings mm-hmm. and maybe see some of those patterns that had happened in childhood, start to seek out some therapy and get some help in noticing those things. The graduate program was a master's in creative writing. So that was like a big leap for me. I knew there wasn't a guaranteed career afterwards, but I just decided I had to do it, even if it meant shuttling back and forth to help take care of my mom or doing things from a distance.
Sure. When you mentioned your mom in early childhood and said you didn't get a lot of attention, and that's often where we don't get a sense of worthiness, because to feel worthy, we have to feel seen, heard, validated, and acknowledged. So is there a point where you had to learn to give that to yourself?
Yeah, I think there have been many points. Probably going away to graduate school was the biggest leap initially. Over the years, again, through my creative practice, which I think is true for a lot of people, actually, that through some sort of creative practice or following our passion, we are able to listen to that intuition and listen to that inner voice that allows mm-hmm. us to feel heard, seen, and validated for the first time. Probably it really didn't come into effect until I got married to my husband about 5 years ago. And really started having to do the work of true intimacy. Mm-hmm. Initially in our relationship, I felt like I had found my person. I was so happy. It felt like it had taken a while to find someone who was so supportive and kind and that I got along with so well, that I was afraid of some of that same abandonment that mm-hmm. happened when I was younger with my mother. Mm-hmm. Whenever I would ask for something that I needed, or whenever one of us would get sick, it seemed like her needs or her pain would then take over.
Sure.
Like she got afraid of not being paid attention to then. I think a lot of that transferred over to my relationship with my husband, and I became really afraid to ask for what I needed. Mm-hmm. I've always been really disciplined about taking time for writing in the mornings, like at least an hour or two. And I stopped doing that. I tried to squeeze my spiritual practice into any gaps that I could find, sitting to meditate when he wasn't home because he wasn't as into practicing that with me. And so there were all these ways that I would just put off my own needs. Mm-hmm. And I think out of fear that if he really truly got to know me and see me for who I am and what I needed, that he would abandon me and would not then want to be in a relationship with me. If I seemed like I was someone who had needs right. or whose needs were different than his, then he might want to leave.
So it sounds like you've done a lot of healing on that, to be 5 years into this relationship, expressing your needs now and doing yeah. the beautiful work that you're doing and setting time aside for that.
Yeah, there has been a lot of healing, and I think there's still a lot more healing mm-hmm. to do as well. My husband and I, Brad, were just talking about how difficult it is to actually ask for what you need. Like I recently had to push back with a publisher because they want a different title for my next book, and I really strongly have this intuitive sense that the title needs to be this thing that I came up with, and they disagree. And so I had to write this really difficult email. And I was just asking him, like, does it still make you a little sick to your stomach to have to ask for what you need sure. so strongly from someone? And he's, yeah, of course. And I think that never, especially if you've grown up in a certain way and you've had trouble putting your needs out there and asking for that, I don't think that little bit of queasiness, which I think is really vulnerability, I don't sure. think that ever entirely goes away.
On this fear of rejection, and then there's a point when you reach and healing that abandonment wound that you're going to be there for yourself, whether
yeah,
someone accepts
absolutely.
You or not. And it sounds like you're doing that right now with the publisher, choosing to really have that need honored that's so important to you based on your intuition.
It's taken me a while, I think, to really believe in the intuition mm-hmm. and to trust in that inner child or that inner voice, whatever we end up calling it, because it so often comes as a whisper. And so mm-hmm. to me, it seems, oh, it can't be that important if it's not this like strong, like you must do this. But when I get still and quiet and really listen inside, I think that's when I realize, oh, this is really important. Mm-hmm. If it keeps coming up for me, then I know if I'm continually ruminating about it, if I'm meditating and it just keeps popping up, then I know it's something that needs to be attended to.
I love, James, how you mentioned that intuition often comes as a whisper, not a loud bang. And I think that's so much of the creative process. But even in living life, you have to go inward to hear that whisper. You can't be busy all the yeah. time and hear that whisper.
Yeah, then that whisper gets drowned out by the noise of the busyness in the outer life. And there's so much noise right now in all of our lives and so much busyness, even with the pandemic, you know, that I think it becomes harder and harder to make that space and to take the solitude
sure.
that it seems to require to really listen to that. And I think that's why it was so hard for me to do that when I first got together with my husband, that it felt so good to be with someone. I thought, oh, everything's answered. I found my person. I don't need to worry about this anymore.
Right.
And then when I got quiet, that whisper kept coming
sure.
up again.
I love this description you have of poetry that you shared in your book. It's an art form especially suited for our challenging times to help us dive deeper beneath the surface of our lives to enter a place of wider, wilder, more universal knowing. Can you elaborate on this knowing? You did a little bit about your intuition, but why connecting with it is so important during these historic times?
I think during these times when things are so uncertain and there's so much to be afraid of and to really genuinely fear, especially for people in BIPOC and targeted communities, there's even more fear and uncertainty. I feel that the quieter kind of grounding practice of poetry, which I believe, as you can probably tell from my book, is accessible to everyone, mm-hmm. that you can write about what's happening to you right now, what you notice, you don't need to use metaphor. You don't need to use any fancy words, that it is really the province of all of us, that we all have access to that. But I believe it's a practice that right. can help us to hold some of the fear and uncertainty, because it can bring us back to the world and it can show us what we care about and what's important to us. I mentioned my moment outside just listening to the crickets and sitting in the sunshine. Mm-hmm. And I'm always trying to capture moments like that, watching a hawk swoop down from a tree, or thinking about an exchange that I had with a cashier at the grocery store, and just wanting to capture that. I think because poetry tends to be a little shorter and it's condensed language, it's really ideal, because you could sit down, write a poem, you can revise it if you want, write it again, mm-hmm. or maybe that's enough to just write it down once. And you have a poem, and you have this moment from your life that you can relive again and again just by reading it. And just by sharing it with someone else, sure. if you choose to do
that. You said some of the poems can be so simple, and that is one of the joys of reading your book. The poems are very easy to follow. They're not really complicated, and diverse representation of the writers. Do you have your book handy? I'd love if you could read one of your poems. Yeah. On page 137, I love that poem called Winter Morning. And before you read it, can you just quickly tell us what prompted you to write that poem? Just like you were talking about hearing the crickets sure. the other day when you're sitting there with your friend?
Yeah. So this came to me actually. It was a winter morning when I was living in Providence, Rhode Island, just before I moved to Vermont to be with my husband. And I didn't really know many people in the city. I was in a very loud apartment building, so I wasn't always sleeping well. And I had just woken up. I didn't really want to be awake, didn't want to be sitting at my desk, didn't really feel very thankful or grateful to be alive in that moment. And so I started off the poem with that feeling of ingratitude and I really don't want to do this right now. And the act of writing the poem actually brought me into this space of gratitude. And I was just amazed by the way that happened. So this is Winter Morning.
Excellent.
When I can no longer say thank you for this new day and the waking into it, for the cold scrape of the kitchen chair and the ticking of the space heater glowing orange as it warms the floor near my feet, I know it's because I've been fooled again by the selfish, unruly man who lives in me and believes he deserves only safety and comfort. But if I pause as I do now, and watch the street lights outside winking off one by one like old men closing their cloudy eyes. If I listen to my tired neighbors slamming car doors hard against the morning, and see the steaming coffee in their mugs kissing their chapped lips as they sip and exhale each of their worries white into the icy air around their faces, then I can remember this one life is a gift each of us was handed and told to open. Untie the bow and tear off the paper. Look inside and be grateful for whatever you find, even if it is only the scent of a tangerine that lingers on the fingers long after you've finished peeling it.
It's really beautiful. Perfect for these times too, just to really appreciate the simple things. Throughout the book, James, you offer so much inspiration for loving the world in the name of your book, no matter what is going on. And this question in your intro really stood out for me. Are you happy to be alive? Can you elaborate on what it means to you to be and feel alive?
So that question, my husband and I joke about that now, because there was this moment when I woke up in a really terrible mood one morning and he just looked at me and he said, "Are you happy to be alive? Like, where's your gratitude?" Mm-hmm. I think about that question a lot. We ask each other that jokingly and sometimes not jokingly, sometimes seriously. For me, to be alive means to not just be speeding past the moments of my life, not to be looking past the people in my life, doing my best to first, I would say, tend to myself and my needs and, you know, do self-care for myself, and then look outward and tend to the people and the elements of my own life, whether that's remembering to water the plants inside and outside, or just all these little things that are calling to us. And I think being present in my body enough to remember that joy really is sometimes a choice. It's not always a choice. So sometimes we can't always lift ourselves out of the darkness and the difficulty. But oftentimes I do think joy is a choice, and that we can choose to take joy in just so many of these little things that we're called to do, and ways that we take care of each other, and little rituals and chores and things like that. Mm-hmm. I sometimes struggle with folding the laundry. It's not my favorite chore. So the clothes will sit in the dryer for several days. But I'm trying to learn to really take pleasure in thinking about, okay, I'm doing this for myself. I'm doing this for my husband. Thinking about how we're going to go out into the world wearing these clothes, feeling that they're still warm from the dryer if I manage to fold them in a good amount of time.
So you're focusing on the why.
Focusing on the why. Yeah. And two, I think focusing on the sensation of it. So how does it feel to be doing this? Bringing myself back to just the sensory input of touching warm clothes or doing the dishes, feeling the temperature of the water. And maybe the sun is shining through the kitchen window and just feeling how the light is interacting with the water and the soap suds and things like that. I just think even a few seconds of
noticing. Looking beyond the looking beyond the task and getting into the feelings of the moment. Beautiful. So James, what propelled you to write this particular book, and can you give us a hint at your next one?
So for this book, a lot of people have asked me if I put this together in response to the pandemic. And of course, once the pandemic hit, it was very much in response to that. And I was seeking out poems to include and exercises that I thought were going to help us all through the pandemic and through the kind of process of reemerging from the pandemic. And yet I also had planned to write this book already before the pandemic hit. And it really came to me when my husband and I were traveling in Argentina. And it struck me that, you know, we were interacting with all these people, meeting new people and doing all these new things. And there was so much joy and gratitude, and it seemed like some hope around us that I wasn't feeling in our country at that time. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like this is a need. I try to put together books that, even my own work, that I feel like are going to serve people and that really can help them, whether it's just be more present, be more mindful, or to really get in touch with gratitude, joy, and hope. And that's why I really wanted to put this together. And when we were traveling in Argentina, I really started planting the seed for this and started thinking about a publisher and getting in touch with poets that I knew. And the next one is going to be on kindness and connection, the ways that we are reemerging from the pandemic and the mm-hmm. ways that we never really stopped being together, but we had to do that from a distance. Right. And now I feel that we're learning how to be bodies out in the world again, right, connecting with each other. And I think it helps to have some reminders and, again, some grounding practice through the poetry.
Is that going to be all your own poetry, or are you going to share other poets as well?
It's going to be other poets as well. Mm-hmm. So it'll be another anthology of poetry. And like How to Love the World, it's going to have a bunch of prompts and different practices that people can do throughout as well.
Okay. And when might we see that one?
That is scheduled for, I believe, March or April of
next year.
March or April of 2022.
Okay. I like how you just also said the book is much more than poetry. And you do invite the reader throughout your current book to reflect and write about significant questions you offer that may help them embrace more gratitude, hope, and joy, which are your core themes. Is there one particular question that you could offer our listeners today who may be feeling confused, in despair, or hopeless?
I go back to, are you happy to be alive? I think that's one question that we can always be carrying. But in some ways, that question feels a little confrontational. I think the mm-hmm. question would be, how do you feel alive? It's a question that you posed to me, Gail. So how are you feeling alive today, and what are you alive to? I would say another question might be, what's calling to you today? What's drawing you toward it? It might be an object, it might be a person, or it might be a practice. What can you do to bring yourself back to the moment and back to the world as we know it?
I love that one you just said, what are you alive to? In the neuroscience that I use in my coaching practice, one of the things we talk about a lot, and you do this really well in your book, by the way, is open-ended questions is how we rewire the brain. Mm-hmm. So just having that kind of question in the forefront of your brain, what are you alive to? You don't have to know the answer right away, and all of a sudden you'll come alive in new ways. So I love that question. That's very powerful.
No matter what is happening in our world now, know this. You are not your circumstances. Learn how to claim your internal power to thrive in Gail's 6-session coaching package, Creating a New Mindset for Thriving. Discover your hidden beliefs that hold you back. Learn empowering words and feelings that shift your mindset to create anew. Release financial setbacks and other blocks to abundance. Step into a new vision for your life with clearly defined action steps to support it. Be championed and mentored, which is a key to success. Email her at gailjones@claimyourworthiness.com to set up a complimentary 30-minute session to learn more. Gail trained with world-renowned neuroscientists to help you learn to train your brain for optimal outcomes. Check out her website, claimyourworthiness.com, especially her video on the homepage, to catch a glimpse of her expertise.
I also love this quote of yours related to one of the poems in the book, and you say, stepping out of life, even for a short while, can help us return with a new perspective on what seemed unworkable before, and we fall out of the practice of patience. That's a really powerful line. We fall out of the practice of patience. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that?
It makes me think of actually my meditation practice. Mm-hmm. I usually try to meditate for at least a couple of times a day. And I don't do any special posture or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just, you know, stretch out on the couch or just sit in a chair, hands on my lap, and just sit in stillness. But I think often I'll be headachy. I'll be feeling stressed out. Oh my gosh, the tenor of this day is never going to change. Mm-hmm. Like this, I'm never going to be able to work myself out of this mood. And often after 20 or 30 minutes of just sitting in stillness, even if it's not entirely comfortable, mm-hmm. or if my mind feels busy, if it takes a while to settle down, because I do have a busy mind, my mood is different. Mm-hmm. And so that act of stepping away in small ways, like the meditation or going for a walk or doing something that you love, like cooking or writing. And I think it's true of larger ways as well. When we are able to gather safely in groups, I really enjoy going on retreats. And so mm-hmm. stepping away from life for just a few days, being in a new place and getting in touch with myself again, mm-hmm. and hearing those whispers that come from inside.
You talk a little bit more about your book too, in addition to the retreat, how important it is to do nothing. And you say, think back to a time, a moment at hand, and you found the world vivid and lovable again, and small joys bring you back. Vivid and lovable, those are very powerful words. I can see how that would create a shift in a mindset.
Yeah, but I think it goes back to what you mentioned earlier about the practice of patience. And we know that we're mm-hmm. going to fall out of it often, and we're not going to always feel patient. We're going to get upset with people, even strangers, in line at the grocery store, while driving, things like that. But I think the more that we take time for ourselves to do nothing, sit in stillness, whatever feeds the soul for you, the greater our patience then. And that's true of ourselves. So patience with ourselves and patience with the world, because I think it takes time to see the world as vivid and lovable, for some of that noise that's all around us at all times mm-hmm. to settle enough so that we're like, oh, those ants, you know, crawling around are beautiful again. And right. the sunshine on the deck that's hitting it just right is so gorgeous right now. And again, like just that, noticing that for a moment, then going back to your work, going back to whatever you're mm-hmm. doing, I think can just build this muscle of noticing what brings you pleasure or what brings you joy.
And it seems to be all about self-care, is it not?
It is.
Yeah. And another favorite quote of mine in your book about relinquishing guilt over time for self, you say, "But the more we take time for ourselves throughout each day, the less we feel obliged to act a certain way or complete a list of tasks just to please someone else." Now, that quote speaks to me volumes of worthiness, that we're worthy to make ourselves and our time a priority, regardless of what anyone else thinks. And that's a huge leap, because when we live in states of unworthiness, we're often people pleasers. So
that's right.
That's a really beautiful quote.
Yeah, I love the title of your podcast, because worthiness is so important and it's such a big, spacious word. I think that one of the ways we reclaim our worthiness is to stop trying to please not just other people, but everyone. I still struggle with this so much because I want everyone to like me.
Right.
And my husband reminds me, probably half of people are just not going to like you and there's nothing you can do about it. And that sort of takes some pressure off.
Right.
Oh yeah, people are not going to like me and that's okay.
And then when you reach the point too, when you see that whether someone likes you or not actually has nothing to do with you. It's a projection of their own wounding.
That's right.
And there's nothing you can do to make them like you.
Exactly. And so no amount of hustling or pleasing or doing everything for everyone is really going to make them like you or bolster your worthiness. The Buddhist teacher, Sylvia Boorstein, she has a great book title. It's called Happiness is an Inside Job. Mm-hmm. And so I would say worthiness is an inside
Absolutely.
Job too.
It has to come from within. Nothing outside of you can make you feel worthy. That's a
That's
great
right.
point. So James, in closing, are there any thoughts or suggestions you have for our listeners today about how to love the world and themselves?
I think really paying attention to what you're doing and why you're doing it. Looking at what you do in a given day and asking yourself, do I really want to be doing this? And do I have a choice? So sometimes we don't have a choice. There are many things that we have to do in our lives right. that I have to get the snow tires changed on the car, do all these little things. But there right. are many things that we choose to do that we don't necessarily have to do. I think a lot of it is pleasing other people. I think a lot of it is maybe we've created a story that I do this with my husband all the time. Oh, he really wants me to run this errand today, so I need to rearrange everything to do this. And then he's, I didn't ask you to do that. You didn't have right. to do that. And I realized that was my story. So
right.
I think looking at what you're doing, why you're doing it, do I really want to be doing this? And do I have a choice? And then what stories am I kind of following and making up about why I'm doing things
right.
or what I'm being led to?
I would think it must be fascinating for your students to have you as their professor. How is teaching for you relating to writing poetry?
Well, a lot of my students say that my classes are like therapy.
Uh-huh. I can imagine.
Yeah, because we are getting into the kinds of conversations that you and I are having mm-hmm. right now, because I'm only interested in the deeper stuff. And like I tell them, we're not interested in the kind of poetry that's just like experiment, wordplay. I'm interested in poetry as a gateway to how you're living your life. And writing as a tool for living a better life. You know, a lot of them walk away from the class feeling like more confident writers, feeling better about their own writing, and really with a new tool, and I get a little emotional actually talking about it, with a new tool to deal with these difficult times. Many
right.
of them are so anxious and struggling so much, especially with remote right. learning. And being isolated. And I think they're so surprised at how writing down their stories, just getting it out of their heads and their hearts and seeing it as a made thing is so beautiful and so useful at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's almost
really
like they go on a healing journey with you when they're being taught how to write poetry, huh?
I think so. They definitely... A lot of them hear that the class is going to be mainly about poetry because it's usually like intro to creative writing mm-hmm. or just general creative writing. And so they hear it's going to be about poetry and their hackles instantly go up. They instantly get afraid. So many of them tell me, I almost dropped the class when you said that, mm-hmm. but I decided to stick with it. And it is a healing journey because I think anytime you're agreeing to go a little deeper than the surface, like I said, with poetry, you're agreeing to be vulnerable and you're agreeing to put yourself on the line a little bit and try some new things. And that's never easy, never easy.
Have you noticed the students being more open to being vulnerable or healing as a result of the pandemic, that they're more anxious than they were?
Yes, definitely. They are both more anxious and more hungry for, I would say, spirituality or some kind of spiritual guidance.
Really?
And hungrier for deeper conversation. Yeah. Because their world, they're inheriting a world that feels so fearful, so uncertain. Mm-hmm. And they don't have a lot of tools for resilience because they have been living in a world that feels more fearful and uncertain for much longer, a much greater proportion of their lives than a lot of us have. And so I find them very hungry and very open to doing the work. Of course, not everyone. And they are more comfortable, I would say, in some ways. They like interacting in person, but they're a lot more comfortable sharing their work one-on-one with me and having that kind of intimate relationship.
So have you had to change your teaching styles? I know being online, but have you changed like the messages at all to help them through this fear?
Yeah, definitely. This is another way that I have claimed my own worthiness and kind of stepped into my own role with them, is that I've just decided that, you know, I have a PhD, I'm trained as an academic, but I don't gravitate toward that as much anymore. It's not an academic pursuit for me, poetry and writing. It's a life pursuit. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a lot less fearful of, am I being rigorous enough? Am I challenging them enough? And my question now is basically, am I loving enough toward them? Am I tender enough with them? They need someone who cares. They need people who care in their lives. Mm-hmm. And these are mostly college-age students that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's my question now. Am I really being loving enough? And am I being aware of what they need? And so the materials that I bring in are poems that touch on the pandemic struggles of this time, poems that are about kindness, connection, and gratitude, and that can show them a way to be in the world and not see it, to see that it's broken and that there's so much to be done, but also to see that it's a beautiful place and that we deserve moments of joy as well, and that we can rest into those moments too.
I love that. I love that. So you're a real inspiration for these young people. How lucky they are to have you for a professor.
I try to be.
I really want to thank you so much for joining us today. You really are a breath of fresh air and inspiring us to find those moments of joy and feeling alive. So to learn more about James and his work, you can check out his website, jamescrews.net. Again, that is James Crews with an S at the end, crews.net. And his latest book, How to Love the World, is available on Amazon and elsewhere. Have a beautiful day.
Thanks so much, Gail.
Thank you for joining me on our journey today. I am so grateful you are part of my podcast community, where it is my dream that by claiming our worthiness together, we can more impactfully shed our light and love on this world. In future podcasts, I'll be sharing more stories of hope and unlimited possibilities for creating anew. You can also follow me on Instagram or on my Facebook page. I also hope you'll be inspired to share my podcast with your friends. Together, we are stronger. Blessings, Gail.
Instagram and Facebook @CoachGailJones.